You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Eric Newman. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including Grants Pass being discussed by the U.S. Supreme Court and protests that closed the Cal Poly Humboldt campus. I'm here with reporters Justin Higginbottom and Roman Battaglia. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
JPR reporter Jane Vaughn is out today, but we'll start with a big story that she's been covering in recent weeks. That's the U.S. Supreme Court's consideration of a homelessness case out of Grants Pass. Here's my conversation from yesterday with Jane. Hi, Jane. So oral arguments for this case happened on Monday. What did they say?
So a little bit of background first. The case is called Grants Pass versus Johnson. I've talked about it a lot. Basically, the question in the case is whether or not it's cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment for the city to be enforcing its public camping laws through tickets and fines when there's nowhere else for homeless people to go in the city because there's no low barrier shelters. So the oral arguments for that case was on Monday morning. It took about 2.5 hours. The attorney on the city's behalf is named Theanae Evangelist. She's from L.A., and her basic argument is that the city's laws are essential for public health and safety, and that earlier court rulings in this case have sort of tied the city's hands as they're trying to address the homelessness crisis. Mm-hmm. And the justices Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan in particular were really pushing back on her arguments. Sotomayor was saying that only homeless people who are camping and resting in public are being punished. The city isn't punishing stargazers who lay down with a blanket. They're not punishing a baby with a blanket over it. Those are her words. Hmm. They're just punishing people who don't have a home. And one of the points that was talked about a lot on Monday was the difference between status and conduct, which is kind of complicated, but I'm going to try to explain it. So there's a Supreme Court ruling from 1962 called Robinson versus California. And the ruling there basically said that it's unconstitutional for a state to punish someone for being a drug addict, which is a status rather than an act, like committing a crime. So it can be illegal to do things like possess drugs or buy drugs. But the simple status of just sitting and being a drug addict or an alcoholic or whatever the case may be can't be a crime.
Okay.
And so in this case, the homeless respondents are arguing that Grants Pass's ordinances are effectively making it a crime to be homeless in the city, which they say is illegal. The city is arguing the opposite. They're saying that the case has nothing to do with status and homeless people are just being punished for the act of violating the public camping laws. Kagan was kind of pushing back on that argument on Monday, saying it really seems like the city is criminalizing a status rather than an act. The attorney for the city, Theanae Evangelist, was pushing back and saying, no, you know, the city's ordinances don't say it is a crime to be homeless. They're just punishing the act of violating the law. On the other side, we've got Kelsey Corcoran, who's the attorney for the homeless respondents. And she was basically saying that because the city is criminalizing sleeping or resting with a blanket, that's an unavoidable human act. Mm-hmm. Everyone has to do. And so the city is effectively criminalizing the status of being homeless. And so her argument is that there's no difference between a law that straight out punishes homelessness and a law that punishes sleeping or blinking or breathing, in her words, while you're homeless. She's saying that it's all just punishing someone for a status, not an act. And she's arguing that that is illegal because the act is an unavoidable human act, mm-hmm. sleeping. So some of the more conservative justices pushed back on that. Samuel Alito was asking about how would police officers do this on a day-to-day basis if they're not enforcing the public camping laws? Mm-hmm. Would they count the number of people sleeping outside, count the number of shelter beds, ask each person if they've tried to find a bed, look into the conditions of what each shelter might have? Like, how is that actually going to work in theory? And then Justice Neil Gorsuch was bringing up, again, status versus conduct regarding shelter beds. So if you have a mental health problem that makes it hard for you to be in a shelter, or problems with substance misuse, so you can't drink or smoke in a shelter, are those people allowed to sleep outside? Like, where is the line? So these are the sort of things that they were talking about during oral arguments on Monday.
Okay. Wow. That's a lot of recap. Thank you for
that.
This is obviously a big case locally. It's also a big case just throughout the country because we're talking about the Supreme Court. So these arguments happened on Monday. What are you going to be watching for next?
So the court is expected to make a ruling on this case in its current term, which ends in June. So a decision could take a couple months. There are certain days when the court releases its opinion, so I'll be watching for those. I've got them marked in my calendar. And again, as I've said before, this case could really have widespread implications for how cities across the country can regulate homelessness, whether or not they can enforce their public camping laws, you know, depends on how the court rules. But the other interesting thing, I talked to the mayor of Grants Pass, Sarah Bristol, on Monday, and she was saying that, in her words, the Supreme Court is not going to tell the city how to establish more shelter and who pays for it, right? Like, that's the big question, is how is the city going to get more shelter, going to get more affordable housing? Where are they going to get the money for that? Who's going to pay for it? And then, depending on how the court rules, what happens next? What does that mean for the people sleeping outside, and what's going to change there? So we'll have to see, depending on how the court rules.
Okay. Thanks for bringing us that update.
Thanks.
Roman, you and Kelby McIntosh have been reporting on a pro-Palestine protest happening at Cal Poly Humboldt. It's part of this growing number of protests on college campuses across the country. Tell us what's happening in Northern California.
Yeah, so a group of protesters have been occupying at least one building on the Cal Poly Humboldt campus since Wednesday. They've been protesting the ongoing war in Gaza, and they've been occupying Siemens Hall, which is home to the school's business college and a number of administrative offices, including the president's office. And the university says they're also occupying Nelson Hall East, which is home to two cultural centers. But according to the Lost Coast Outpost, the activists have disputed the occupation of that building. They say their activities are limited to Siemens Hall. They block the entrances to the buildings with furniture, like tables and chairs. There's also people camping outside, and a lot of students, faculty, and community members are on campus supporting the protesters. There was a violent clash between the protesters and local police on Monday night that ended up leading to three arrests. But it seems like the police have backed off since then. According to people I've talked to, the campus is pretty peaceful right now. Members from the California Faculty Association, which is a union, held a teach-in on Wednesday to talk about the Israeli-Palestine conflict. And that looked pretty well attended from the live streams I was watching on social media.
Okay. So what are the protesters' demands?
Yeah, so their demands are pretty similar to what we've heard from other protesters at universities across the country, like Columbia, NYU, and USC. They're demanding that the university be transparent about their investments. They want the university to completely divest from Israeli-linked companies. They also want the university to cut ties with Israeli universities, and then they also want an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
And so what have we heard from the university administration?
Yeah, so I've tried multiple times to interview university administration, but they've declined. They've been sending out some statements about the protest over the week. Most of it talks about logistics. The university campus has been closed this whole week, and it's going to be closed through the weekend. So classes have moved online, and they've talked a lot about how that's working and what's going on there. But they also say, you know, there's a risk of occupation of more buildings and that protesters have broken numerous laws. I think at one point, a release they sent on Wednesday said that some of the toilets in the building weren't working, and they want protesters to stop occupying the building and talk peacefully, I guess. They haven't mentioned anything about the protesters' demands so far. I tried to look into the university's investments earlier this week to see if I could find any links to Israel, and it was pretty hard to find information about that. You can see why they want more transparency. They do post these investment performance reports every year for the university's foundation, and in those reports, I ended up combing through every mutual fund the university invested in, and then I compared their holdings with a list from 2020 released by the UN Human Rights Office. That list had businesses with ties to Israeli occupied settlements in the West Bank. A lot of countries have called those settlements illegal. I did find one link there. One of the mutual funds is invested in Airbnb, the vacation rental company. They were under fire back in 2019 and 2020 for having listings on their website in those Israeli settlements. They originally removed those listings, but then they later reversed that decision. And so when I looked on their website, there are still those listings in those Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Obviously, that UN list is not a complete list of companies with links to Israel, but that's kind of the only official list I could find. There's definitely other companies that do business. And, you know, if you look on social media, you see people calling for various companies that are linked to Israel, but those they're not necessarily official links that we can confirm.
Okay. And so how long do we expect this protest to last?
Yeah, we're not really sure. According to the people I've talked with, the protesters are ready to stay there for the long haul until their demands are met. They're getting food and supplies through the windows, but we're not really sure what's going to happen after this weekend. The university has said it's preparing clearing to possibly stay closed for longer if needed. We've also seen in some other protests across the country, like in Colombia, they're talking about dispersing the camp this weekend or today. We also haven't heard directly from Cal Poly Humboldt's president, Tom Jackson. The protesters have the support from the faculty, and according to the Lost Coast Outpost last night, the general faculty overwhelmingly approved a vote of no confidence in the president. They're essentially demanding his resignation. A CFA representative told the news site that this vote was mostly about the president's inaction, that he hasn't said anything publicly about the protests or what they're doing. And then they're also demanding that the university doesn't discipline or arrest the protesting students. So, you know, we'll keep people updated as this develops because obviously it's still an ongoing situation.
Okay. Thanks, Roman. Justin, we're going to turn to you now. You reported on an update to a Bureau of Land Management timber sale this week. Can you tell us why that sale was so controversial?
Yeah, so protesters had been camped in the area of that sale for the last 3 weeks, actually. That included a tree sitter, this person camping on a platform attached near the top of this big 100-foot-tall ponderosa pine. And they were all there protesting a proposed road by a logging company through that area that they claim endangered old-growth trees. They said these large-diameter trees in the area where they're camped would basically be cut down to make way for that road. This is in the Salmon Run timber sale area, and that's part of the BLM's Poor Windy project in Josephine County. It's right off the I-5 near Wolf Creek, and that's over 10,000 acres. The project area is over 10,000 acres. Some of that forest is set to be commercially logged, and then there's other parts, other areas that will, there'll be fuel reduction programs there to prevent wildfires from getting out of control. So I went out and visited the protesters a couple weeks ago, and where they're camped, you can kind of see these large diameter or old growth trees marked with a band of paint. That marking usually is meant to let operators know not to cut them down because, you know, the BLM has rules against cutting down trees that are of a certain diameter, but there's exceptions, like if they're in the way of construction, like construction of a road.
Okay. So what changed in the plan for the BLM and this logging company in this timber sale area?
So they canceled that road where the protesters were. BLM and Boise Cascade Wood Products, that's the timber sale operator, they decided not to build that proposed 440-foot access road. They also updated their plan to specify that construction of another road, which that'll go forward, but that construction won't disturb large diameter trees. And protesters really celebrated this decision. They claimed it was their actions that caused it. Here's Sam Shields, an organizer that worked with those on the ground.
We believe this is just a fantastic precedent for further action to be taken against the Bureau of Land Management's continued practice of targeting old and mature forests on public lands.
So as you can hear, he was pretty clear that, you know, he sees this tactic of direct action like tree sitting as pretty effective, and it could be used in the future. This isn't the only project in Southern Oregon that conservationists have a problem with.
And so you also reached out to the Bureau of Land Management. What did the BLM say?
Well, the BLM has said that their timber sales do not target old growth trees. And the Salmon Run sale didn't include the sale of any old growth trees. When I interviewed a BLM spokesperson previously, they said that any of these large diameter trees that are felled, they're just basically left on the forest floor. Operators don't want them generally. Most mills in Oregon can't even take them. The BLM wouldn't say that this road cancellation was caused by the activists. They said the decision was made in early April as part of kind of regular coordination between the BLM and that timber company, although that new contract was signed this week.
Okay. Thanks so much, Justin. That's going to do it for the debrief today. Just a quick reminder that we are reaching the end of our April fund drive. If you appreciate conversations like this with kind of an expanded conversation about these local stories that Jefferson Public Radio's reporters are covering, now's a great time to show your support. You can do that by giving us a call at 888-552-6191 or going to our website at ijpr.org/support. You can reach the newsroom with comments about our coverage and suggestions for things that we should cover in the future on our news tip line. You can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org, or you can subscribe on all the usual platforms.